say. She didn't tell me our source for that information. Correct, I repeat. My way of saying, and we're not going to tell you the source, Sam. He waits a beat and realizes that more will not be forthcoming. Cocks his head, but otherwise doesn't respond. All right, well, sir, if that's the case, then I acknowledge that the timing is suspect. But still, I must tell you that this feels different. Dark Ages is malware, a virus we discovered. Well, we didn't exactly discover it. They, Augie and Nina, showed it to us. But Sam doesn't know that. He doesn't know that Augie even exists. Or does he? But this seems to be a more conventional method, like spear phishing, he continues. Trying to compromise a company executive, lulling him into opening an attachment on an email or clicking on a link, which installs a malicious code that lets the hacker gain access to credentials and all kinds of sensitive information. Once you exfiltrate credentials and have that kind of access, you could do all sorts of things, like what happened here. But how do we know that's different from Dark Ages? Carolyn presses. We can't say that Dark Ages didn't come from spear phishing. We have no idea how the virus got on the system. You're correct. I can't rule it out yet. It's only been a couple of hours. We'll get right to work on it. We'll get an answer. ASAP. ASAP has a new meaning today. Mr. President, says Sam, we've reached out to all the gas companies about pipeline security. ICS CERT is working with them on emergency mitigation protocols. We're hopeful we can stop this from happening again.
Mr. President, Alex nudges me.
Our SUV has reached the helipad in eastern Virginia, the majestic green and white Marine helicopter, illuminated only by the lights around the pad. Sam, I'm going to let you get back to it for now, I say. Keep Carolyn and Liz in the loop at all times, and only them. Is that clear?
Yes, sir. I'm signing off.
Sam's third of the screen disappears. The screen adjusts, and Carolyn and Liz appear in larger images. I turn to Alex. Get Augie onto Marine One. I'll be right there. I wait for Alex and Augie to leave the SUV, then I turn to Carolyn and Liz. I say, why would they want to blow up a defense contractor's airplane plant? Chapter 48.
I have no idea, says Augie when I ask him the same question.
We are sitting inside Marine One, seated across from each other in lush, cream-colored leather seats as the helicopter lifts silently into the air.
I am not aware of any such action, he says. I played no part in such a thing.
Hacking into a pipeline system or a defense contractor's system, you never did things like that.
Mr. President, if we are speaking generally, then yes, we have done such things. You are talking about spear phishing, you said.
Yes.
Then yes, we have done these things. The Chinese perfected the art initially. They attempted to hack into your gas pipeline system, did they not?
The same point Sam Haber made.
This is a matter of public knowledge, what the Chinese did, says Augie. But we did not do that here. Or I should say, I did not do that.
Is Suleiman Jindorik capable of hacking into our pipelines without you?
Of course he is. He has a team of such people. I would say that I was probably the most advanced, but we are not speaking of something that is difficult. Anyone can load a virus onto an email and then hope that the target clicks on it.
The wild, wild west, this cyber terrorism, this new scary frontier. Anyone sitting on a couch in his underwear could undermine the security of a nation. You never heard anything about Los Angeles?
No.
I sit back in my chair. So you don't know anything about this?
I do not, he says. And I cannot understand what would be to gain from blowing up a company that builds airplanes for you.
I can't disagree. What purpose would it serve to destroy a manufacturing plant? There has to be something more to this. Okay,
Okay, Augie. I rub my eyes, fighting off exhaustion from the platelet transfusion, fighting off exasperation, constantly not knowing what is coming next. So tell me. Tell me how you infiltrated our systems and tell me what damage it will cause. Finally, we have the chance. Since we first met at the stadium, what with dodging bullets and escaping from car ambushes and my collapsing near midnight, we haven't had the chance to lock this down.
I can assure you that our efforts were not so rudimentary as sneaking viruses into emails and hoping someone would open them, he says. And I can assure you that your code word, Dark Ages, is an appropriate one.
Chapter 49. I forced down some coffee on Marine One, hoping to snap out of the medication-induced fog. I have to be on my game, 100%. This next step could be the most critical of all. Dawn is just breaking. The clouds a magnificent fiery orange. Ordinarily, I'd be deeply moved by the sight, a reminder of the omnipotence of nature, of how small we are in this world we inherited. But the clouds are instead a reminder of the fireball I just watched in Los Angeles via satellite images, and the rising sun tells me that the clock is ticking in deep, echoing gongs.
They're ready for us, Alex Trimble tells me, looking up at me from conversations he's having through his headset. The communications room is secure. The war room is secure. The grounds are swept and secure. Barricades and cameras are in place.
We land effortlessly in a spot designed for helicopter landing, a square of open land among the vast woodlands of southwestern Virginia. We're in the middle of an estate owned by a friend of mine, a venture capitalist who, by his own admission, doesn't know a damn thing about what he calls computer technical stuff, but recognized a winner when he smelled it, investing millions in a startup software company and turning those millions into billions. This is his getaway, his place to fish on the lake or hunt deer when he's not in Manhattan or Silicon Valley. More than 1,000 acres of Virginia pines and wildflowers, hunting and boating, long hikes and campfires. Lily and I came here a few weekends after Rachel's death, sitting on the pontoon, taking long walks, trying to find the secret to coping with loss.
We're the first ones here, right? I ask Alex.
Yes, sir.
Good. I want at least a few minutes first to put some pieces in place and clean myself up a bit. There is no room for error now.
In the next few hours, we could be altering world history for generations. South of our landing spot, there are paths leading to the boat dock, but otherwise all you can see is dense woodlands. North of us is a cabin built more than a decade ago out of white pine logs, the color of the wood having turned over the years from yellow-brown to a darker orange that almost matches the sky at dawn. One of the best things about this place, particularly from Alex's perspective, is a lack of accessibility. There's no way to enter this property from the south or west, because it is protected by a 30-foot-high electric fence fitted with sensors and cameras. The east side of the property abuts a massive lake, which is guarded by Secret Service agents standing on the dock. And to access the property by car, you have to find an unmarked gravel road off the county highway, then turn down a dirt road barricaded by Secret Service vehicles. I insisted on light protection because this location has to remain secret. What is about to happen has to remain completely confidential, and the Secret Service tends to stand out when it's in full force. It's intended to stand out. We've struck a good balance between secure and inconspicuous. I walk on unsteady legs up the slight incline, carrying the IV stand in my hand because the wheels do not comfortably roll across the thick grass. The air out here is so different, so fresh and clean and sweet with the scent of wildflowers, that I am tempted to forget for the moment that the world may be on the brink of catastrophe. On one side of the open lawn, a tent has been set up, all black. If not for the color and the fact that a drape covers all sides, it would look like any other tent set up for an outdoor party. Instead, it is a tent set up to allow private conversations, either in person or electronic, to occur in utter seclusion, jamming out all other signals, any attempts at eavesdropping. There are going to be a lot of critical and confidential conversations today. The agents have the cabin open. Inside, the rustic theme has been retained to a large extent. Some wildlife trophies mounted on the walls, pictures hung in pine frames, a carved-out canoe serving as a bookcase. A man and a woman stand at attention as I enter, taking note of the IV in my arm but saying nothing. The man is Devin Whitmer, age 43, looking like a college professor, a sport jacket and trousers, dress shirt open at the collar, his long hair brushed back, some gray peppering the beard covering his thin face, otherwise youthful in appearance but with bags under his eyes that reflect the stress he's endured over the last 2 weeks. The woman is Casey Alvarez, age 37, slightly taller than Devin and with a bit more of a corporate America look. Her ink-black hair pulled back, red eyeglasses, a blouse, and black pants. Devin and Casey are the co-chairs of the Imminent Threat Response Team, part of a task force I assembled after the virus we dubbed Dark Ages made its cameo peekaboo appearance on Pentagon servers 2 weeks ago. I told my people I wanted only the best, whatever it took, wherever they came from, whatever it cost. We assembled 30 people. The brightest cybersecurity minds we have. A few are on loan pursuant to strict confidentiality agreements from the private sector. Software companies, telecommunications giants, cybersecurity firms, military contractors. Two are former hackers themselves, one of them currently serving a 13-year sentence in a federal penitentiary. Most are from various agencies of the federal government. Homeland Security, CIA, FBI, NSA. Half our team is devoted to threat mitigation, how to limit the damage to our systems and infrastructure after the virus hits. But right now, I'm concerned with the other half, the threat response team that Devin and Casey are running. They're devoted to stopping the virus, something they've been unable to do for the last 2 weeks.
"Good morning, Mr. President," says Devin Whitmer. He comes from NSA. After graduating from Berkeley, he started designing cyber defense software for clients like Apple before the NSA recruited him away. He has developed federal cybersecurity assessment tools to help industries and governments understand their preparedness against cyber attacks. When the major healthcare systems in France were hit with a ransomware virus 3 years ago, we lent them Devin, who was able to locate and disable it. Nobody in America, I've been assured, is better at finding holes in cyber defense systems or at plugging them.
"Mr. President," says Casey Alvarez. Casey is the daughter of Mexican immigrants who settled in Arizona to start a family and built up a fleet of grocery stores in the Southwest along the way. Casey showed no interest in the business, taking quickly to computers and wanting to join law enforcement. When she was a grad student at Penn, she got turned down for a position at the Department of Justice. So Casey got on her computer and managed to do what state and federal authorities had been unable to do for years. She hacked into an underground child pornography website and disclosed the identities of all the website's patrons, basically gift-wrapping a federal prosecution for justice and shutting down an operation that was believed to be the largest purveyor of kiddie porn in the country. DOJ hired her on the spot, and she stayed there until she went to work for the CIA. She's been most recently deployed in the Middle East with U.S. Central Command, where she intercepts, decodes, and disrupts cyber communications among terrorist groups. I've been assured that these two are by far the best we have, and they are about to meet the person who, so far, has been better. There is a hint of reverence in their expressions as I introduce them to Augie. The Sons of Jihad is the all-star team of cyber terrorists, mythical figures in that world. But I sense some competitive fire, too, which will be a good thing. "Devin and Casey can show you to their war room," I say, and they're in touch with the rest of the threat response team back at the Pentagon. "Follow me," says Casey to Augie. I feel a small measure of relief. At least I've got them together. After everything we went through, this itself is a small victory. Now I can focus on what comes next.
"Jacobson," I say once they've left, "remove this IV. before he's finished, sir? I stare back at him. You know what's about to happen, don't you?
Yes, sir. Of course.
Right. And I'm not going to have a damn tube in my arm. Take it out.
Sir, yes, sir.
He gets to work, snapping on rubber gloves from his bag and gathering the other supplies. He starts talking to himself like a kid, trying to memorize the steps in an instruction manual.
Close the clamp, stabilize catheter, pull dressing and tape toward the injection site, and...
Ouch!
Sorry, sir. No sign of infection. Here.
He places a gauze pad over the site.
Hold this down.
A moment later, I'm taped up and ready to go. I go straight to my bedroom, into the small bathroom inside it. I pull out an electric razor and shave off most of the red beard, then use a razor and shaving cream to finish the job. Then I shower, taking the moment to enjoy the pressure of the steaming water on my face. Awkward as it may be with my left arm hanging outside the shower, protecting the gauze pad and tape, doing everything with one hand. Still, I needed a shower. I needed a shave. I feel better, and appearances still matter, at least for one more day. I put on the clean clothes that Carolyn's husband gave me. I'm still wearing my jeans and shoes, but he gave me a button-down shirt that fits okay, plus clean boxers and socks. I've just finished combing my hair when I get a text message from FBI Liz, telling me that we need to talk.
Alex, I call out. He pops into the bedroom.
Where the hell are they?
I understand they're close, sir.
But everything's okay?
I mean, after what we went through last night. My understanding, sir, is that they are secure and on their way.
Double check that, Alex. I dial my FBI director's number.
Yes, Liz. What is it?
Mr. President, news on Los Angeles, she says. They weren't targeting the defense contractor.
Chapter 50. I head to the basement, to a room on the East End, where the owner of this cabin, with the help of the CIA, was good enough to install a soundproof door and set up secure communications lines for my use when I visit. This communications room is several doors down from the war room on the west side of the basement, where Augie, Devin, and Casey are set up. I close the door and plug the secure line into my laptop and pull up the triumvirate of Carolyn Brock, Liz Greenfield, and Sam Haber of Homeland Security on a three-way split screen.
Talk to me, I say. Hurry.
Sir, on the same block as the defense contractor's plant was a private health laboratory that was in a partnership with the state of California, NRCDC.
The Centers for Disease Control, I say.
Correct, sir. Within the CDC, we have a laboratory response network. It, essentially, we have about 200 laboratories around the country designed as first responders to biological and chemical terrorism.
A cold wave passes through my chest.
The largest member of the laboratory response network in the greater Los Angeles area was next door to the defense contractor's plant. It was decimated in the fire, sir.
I close my eyes. Are you telling me that the primary lab charged with responding to a bioterrorism attack in L.A. was just burned to the ground?
Yes, sir.
Holy shit. I rub my temples.
Yes, sir. That about sums it up.
And what exactly does the lab do, or did it do?
It was the first to diagnose, he says. The first to treat. Diagnosis being the most critical aspect, understanding what exactly our citizens have been exposed to is the first order of business for first responders. You can't treat the patient if you don't know what you're treating.
Nobody speaks for a moment.
Are we looking at a biological attack on Los Angeles? I ask.
Well, sir, we're making that assumption right now. We're in touch with the local authorities.
Okay, Sam. Do we have protocols in place to divert CDC operations around the country?
We're doing it right now, sir. We're mobilizing resources from other cities on the West Coast.
A predictable response, what the terrorists would expect. Is this a head fake?
are they fainting toward L.A., so we'll move everything on the West Coast there, then hit another spot like Seattle or San Francisco while our guard is down. I throw up my hands. Why do I feel like we're chasing our goddamn tails here, people?
Because it always feels that way, sir, says Sam. It's what we do. We play defense against invisible opponents. We try to smoke them out. We try to predict what they might do. We hope it never happens, but try to be as ready as possible if it does.
Is that supposed to make me feel better? Because it doesn't.
Sir, we're on this. We'll do everything we can.
I run my fingers through my hair. Get to it, Sam. Keep me updated.
Yes, sir.
The screen adjusts to show just Carolyn and Liz as Sam signs off. Any more good news, I ask? A hurricane on the East Coast? Tornadoes? An oil spill? Is a goddamn volcano erupting somewhere?
One thing, sir, says Liz, about the gas explosion.
Something new?
She cocks her head. More like something old, she says.
Liz fills me in, and I didn't think I could feel any worse. 10 minutes later, I open the thick door and leave the communications room as Alex approaches me. He nods to me.
They just reached the security perimeter up the road, says Alex. The Israeli Prime Minister has arrived.
Chapter 51. The delegation for the Israeli Prime Minister, Noya Barum, arrives as planned, one advance car that arrived earlier and now two armored SUVs, one carrying a security detail that will leave once she has safely arrived, and the other carrying the Prime Minister herself. Noya emerges from the SUV, wearing sunglasses, a jacket, and slacks. She looks up at the sky for a moment, as if to confirm that it's still there. It's one of those days. Noya is 64. With gray dominating her shoulder-length hair and dark eyes that can be both fierce and engaging. She is one of the most fearless people I've ever known. She called me the night I was elected president. She asked if she could call me Johnny, which nobody in my life had ever done. Surprised, off balance, giddy from the win, I said, sure you can. She's called me that ever since.
Johnny...
She says to me now, removing her sunglasses and kissing both my cheeks. With her hands clasped over mine, a tight smile on her face, she says,
you look like someone who could use a friend right now.
I certainly could.
You know that Israel will never leave your side.
I do know that, I say, and my gratitude knows no bounds, Noya.
David has been helpful.
Very. I reached out to Noya when I discovered the leak in my national security team. I didn't know whom I could trust, and whom I couldn't. So I was forced to outsource some of my reconnaissance work to the Mossad, dealing directly with David Gralnick, its director. Noya and I have had disagreements over the two-state solution and settlements on the West Bank, but when it comes to the things that bring us together today... There is no daylight between our positions. A safe and stable United States means a safe and stable Israel. They have every reason to help us and no reason not to. And they have the finest cybersecurity experts in the world. They play defense better than anybody. Two of them have arrived with Noya and will join Augie and my people.
I am the first to arrive.
You are, Noya. You are. And I wouldn't mind having a word with you before the others get here. If I had time to give you a tour.
What? A tour?
She waves her hand.
It's a cabin. I've seen cabins before.
We walk past the cabin into the yard. She acknowledges the black tent. We walk toward the woods, the trees 30 feet high, the wildflowers, yellow and violet, following the stone path to the lake. Alex Trimble follows from behind, speaking into his radio. I will tell her everything she doesn't already know, which isn't very much.
What we have heard about so far, she says, did not sound like plans for a biological attack in a major city.
I agree, but maybe the idea is to destroy our ability to respond, then introduce some biological pathogen.
That would include destroying physical buildings and our technological infrastructure.
True, true, she says.
The gas pipeline explosion could be telling.
How so?
Some computer virus, some malware, caused a disruption, I say. We just confirmed it a few minutes ago. The virus prompted a forced increase in pressure that caused the explosion.
Yes, and?
I let out air and stopped, turned to her.
Noya, in 1982, we did the same thing to the Soviets.
Ah, you sabotaged one of their pipelines.
My FBI director just told me. Reagan learned that the Soviets were trying to steal some industrial software, I say. So he decided to let them steal it. But we tampered with it first. We booby-trapped it. So when the Soviets stole it and used it, it caused a tremendous explosion in the Siberian pipeline. Our people said that the satellite imagery showed one of the biggest explosions they'd ever seen.
She laughs in spite of the circumstances. Reagan, she says, shaking her head. I had not heard this story, but it sounds like him.
She angles her head, looks up at me.
This is ancient history, though.
Yes and no, I say. We learned that a number of people were disciplined for the mistake. It was a huge embarrassment for the Kremlin. A lot of people were punished. Some went to prison for life. We never knew all the details, but one of the KGB agents who was never heard from again was named Viktor Chernikov. Her smile disappears.
The Russian president's father.
The Russian president's father. She nods knowingly.
I knew his father was KGB. I didn't know how he died or why.
She chews on her lip, something she always does when she concentrates.
So, what are you going to do with this information, Johnny?
Mr. President, excuse me, sir. Excuse me, Madam Prime Minister. I turn to Alex.
What is it, Alex?
Sir, he says, the German Chancellor is arriving.
Chapter 52. Jürgen Richter, the German Chancellor, steps out of his SUV looking like something out of British royalty in his pinstriped three-piece suit. He has a slight paunch, but he has the height, 6'4", and the perfect posture to carry it off. His long, regal face lights up when he sees Noya Barum. He bows at the waist in exaggerated fashion, which he waves off with a laugh. Then they embrace. She's more than a foot shorter than he is, so she rises up and he leans down so they can exchange kisses. I offer my hand and he accepts it, clasping my shoulder with the other hand, the large hand of a former basketball player for West Germany in the 1988 Olympics.
Mr. President, he says, always these difficult situations we meet.
The last time I saw Jürgen was at Rachel's funeral. How is your wife, Mr. Chancellor? I ask. His wife now has cancer, too, and is getting treatment in the United States.
She is a strong woman, Mr. President. Thank you for your concern. She has never lost a battle. Certainly not with me.
He looks over at Noya for a laugh, which she gives him. Jürgen is one of those larger-than-life personalities, always trying for humor. His need to shine has brought him trouble more than once in interviews and press conferences, where he's been known to make an occasional off-color remark. But his voters seem to appreciate his freewheeling style.
I appreciate your coming, I say.
Then one friend has a problem, another friend helps.
True, but the principal reason I invited him is to convince him that the problem is not only my country's, but his, and all of NATO's, too. I show him around the grounds briefly, but my phone is buzzing before long. I excuse myself from the group and answer the phone. 3 minutes later, I'm back downstairs, communicating by laptop on the secure line. Again, it's the same three people involved, Carolyn and Liz, whom I trust, and Sam Haber, who has to be involved in Homeland Security issues, and whom I would really like to believe I can trust, too. Sam Haber was a case officer in the CIA 30 years ago who returned to Minnesota and was elected to Congress. He ran for governor, lost, and managed to get an appointment as one of the CIA's deputy directors. My predecessor appointed him secretary of DHS, and he was given high marks. He lobbied me to be CIA director, but I chose Erica Beatty for that post and asked him to stay on at DHS. I was pleasantly surprised when he agreed. Most of us thought he'd serve in a sort of interim capacity, bridging administrations before moving on to something else. But he's lasted more than 2 years in the job, and if he's unhappy, he hasn't made that known to anyone. Sam's eyes are in a nearly permanent squint, his forehead always etched in wrinkles below the ever-present crew cut. Everything about him is intense. It's not a bad trait in a secretary of Homeland Security. "Where exactly did it happen?" I ask.
"It's in a small town outside Los Angeles proper," says Sam. "It's the largest water treatment plant in California. It pumps more than half a billion gallons of water a day, mostly into L.A. County and Orange County."
"So what happened?"
"Sir, after the explosion at the private biological lab, we were in touch with state and local officials focusing on critical public infrastructure, gas, electricity, commuter rail, but most urgently on water lines."
Makes sense. The most obvious target among public utilities for a biological attack. You introduce a biological pathogen into the water, it spreads faster than wildfire.
"The Metropolitan Water District of Southern California and members of DHS and EPA conducted an emergency inspection and discovered the breach."
"Explain the breach," I say, in English.
"They hacked into the computer software, sir. They managed to alter the settings on the chemical applicators, but they also disabled the alert functions that would normally detect anomalies in the purification process."
So dirty water that was supposed to be passing through a chemical application wasn't receiving that chemical application, and the alert functions in the system designed to detect that very problem
weren't detecting, sir. That's correct. The good news is that we caught it quickly. We caught it within an hour of the cyber intrusion. The untreated water was still in the finished water reservoirs.
No tainted water left the plant.
Sir, that's correct. Nothing had passed into the water mains yet.
Did the water contain any biological pathogens, anything like that?
Sir, we don't know at this point. Our rapid response team in that area,
the lab you'd normally use, burned down 4 hours ago.
Sir, that's correct.
Sam, I need your full attention here. I lean forward toward the screen. You can tell me with 100% confidence no tainted water was sent to the citizens of L.A. or Orange counties.
Sir, that's correct. This was the only plant they breached, and we can pinpoint precisely when the cyber event occurred, when the chemical applicator software and detection systems were compromised. There is no physical way that any untreated water left the plant.
I release a breath. Okay, well, that's something, at least. Well done, Sam.
Yes, sir, a good team effort. But the news isn't all good, sir.
Of course it isn't. Why in the hell would we expect only good news? I wave off my tantrum. Tell me the bad news, Sam.
The bad news is that none of our technicians has ever seen a cyber attack like this. They've been unable, so far, to re-engage the chemical applicators.
They can't fix it?
Exactly, sir. For all practical purposes, the primary water treatment plant serving Los Angeles County and Orange County is closed for business.
Okay, well, surely there are other plants.
Yes, sir, most certainly. But there is no practical way to compensate for the loss for very long. And, sir, I'm concerned that the hacking isn't over yet. What if they hit another plant around L.A. too? We're watching closely now, of course. We'll shut down any affected system and prevent untreated water from reaching the water mains.
But you'd have to shut down the plant too, I say.
Yes, sir.
We could have multiple water treatment plants shut down at once.
What are you telling me, Sam? We could have a massive water shortage in Los Angeles?
That's what I'm telling you, sir.
How many people are we talking about, Los Angeles and Orange counties?
14 million, sir.
Oh, Jesus. I put my hand over my mouth.
We're not just talking about hot showers and lawn sprinklers, he says. We're talking about potable water. We're talking about hospitals and surgery wards and first responders.
So what? This will be Flint, Michigan all over again?
It will be Flint, Michigan, says Sam, multiplied by a factor of 140.
Chapter 53.
But not immediately, says Carolyn. Not today.
Not today, but soon. L.A. County alone is bigger than many states in population, and this is its biggest supplier of clean water. We'll have a crisis starting today. Not Flint, Michigan, not yet, but a real, true blue crisis.
Mobilize FEMA, I say.
Already done, sir.
We can have a federal disaster declaration.
Already have it written for you, sir.
But you have something else in mind?
Yes, sir. Fixing the problem, sir.
That's what I thought he was going to say.
Sir, you know as well as I do that there are many very good, highly competent individuals under our umbrella when it comes to cyber defense. But it looks like very good and highly competent isn't going to cut it today in Los Angeles. Our people there are telling us they've never seen a virus like this. They don't know what to do.
You need the best.
Yes, sir. We need the threat response team you assembled.
Devin Whitmer and Casey Alvarez are with me, Sam. Sam doesn't immediately reply. I'm keeping him in the dark. We both know that. I have a source telling me today is the day for the attack, but I haven't identified the source to him. That's unusual, and on top of that, now I'm telling him what he probably already figured out for himself, that our country's two most elite cybersecurity experts are with me in an undisclosed location. None of this makes any sense to him. He's the Secretary of Homeland Security of all people in the world. Why wouldn't I tell him?
Sir, if we can't have Whitmer and Alvarez, at least send part of the team.
I rub my face, think it over.
This is dark ages, sir. There's no chance this is a coincidence. This is the beginning. Where it ends, I don't know. The rest of the water plants, the electrical grid, are they going to open the dams? We need them in Los Angeles. We got lucky once today. I don't want to count on luck again.
I get out of my chair feeling claustrophobic down here. Pacing helps me. Gets the juices flowing. I need them all flowing in the direction of the best possible decision. The gas explosion, the decimated biological lab, the tampering at the water lab. Wait a minute. Wait just a...
Was it luck, I ask? Finding the malfunction in the water purification plant? I don't know what else I'd call it. It could have been days before they caught this. This was a highly sophisticated hacking.
And it's only because of the destruction of the bioterrorism response laboratory that we thought to manually check the control functions at that water plant.
Correct, sir. It was an obvious first step precaution to take.
I know, I say. That's my point.
I'm not following, sir.
Sam, if you were the terrorist, what order would you do things in? Would you contaminate the water supply first or blow up the lab first? I'll tell you what I'd do first if I were the terrorist. I go on. I'd contaminate the water supply first. It wouldn't be immediately noticeable, maybe within hours, maybe within days. And then I'd blow up the lab. Because if you blow up the lab first, if you blow up a lab dedicated to emergency biological terror response first,
you show your hand, says Carolyn. You know the first thing the federal government will do is check things like the water supply.
Which is exactly what we did, I say.
They showed their hand.
Sam mumbles as much to himself as to us, thinking it over.
They deliberately showed their hand, I say. They tipped us off. They wanted us to go inspect all the water plants. They wanted us to find the cyber intrusion. Sam says, I don't see how that helps. Maybe they don't want to poison the water in Los Angeles. Maybe they just want us to think they do. They want us to send the best, the most elite cybersecurity experts in the nation to L.A., to the other side of the country, so that our pants are at our ankles when the virus strikes. I put my hands on top of my head, work it over again. We're taking an awfully big risk in making that assumption, sir. I start pacing again. Liz, you have any thoughts here? She looks surprised that I'm asking.
You want to know what I do?
Yes, Liz. You went to one of those Ivy League schools, didn't you? What would you do?
Los Angeles is a major metropolitan area. I wouldn't risk it. I'd send the team to L.A. to fix that system.
I nod. Carolyn?
Sir, I understand your logic, but I have to agree with Sam and Liz. Imagine if it ever came out that you decided not to send...
No! I shout, pointing at the computer screen. No politics today. No worrying about what might come out later. This is the whole freaking show, people. Every decision I make today is a risk. We are on the high wire without a net. I make the wrong decision either way, and we're screwed. There's no safe play here. There's only a right play and a wrong play.
Send some of the team then, Carolyn says. Not Devin and Casey, but some of the threat response team at the Pentagon.
That team was put together as a cohesive unit, I say. You can't cut a bicycle in half and still expect it to work. No. It's all or nothing. Do we send them to L.A. or don't we? The room is silent. Sam says,
send them to L.A.
Send them, says Carolyn.
I agree, Liz chimes in.
Three highly intelligent people, all voting the same way. How much of their decision is based on reason and how much on fear? They're right. The smart money says send them. My gut says otherwise.
So what's it going to be, Mr. President?
The team stays put for now, I say. Los Angeles is a decoy.
Chapter 54. Saturday morning, 6:52 a.m. The limousine is parked on 13th Street Northwest by the curb. Vice President Catherine Brandt sits in the back of the limo, her stomach churning, but not from hunger. Her cover is airtight. Every Saturday morning at 7 a.m., she and her husband have a standing reservation for omelets just around the corner on G Street Northwest at Blake's Cafe. They have a table ready for her, and by now her order is assumed. Egg whites with feta cheese and tomatoes, extra crispy hash browns. So she has every reason to be here right now. Nobody would say otherwise if she were ever confronted. Her husband, thank goodness, is out of town. Another golfing trip. Or maybe it's fishing. She loses track. It was easier when they lived in Massachusetts and she was gone during the week when she was in the Senate. Living together in Washington has been hard on them. She loves him, and they still have good times together. But he has no interest in politics, hates Washington, and has nothing to do since he sold his business. It's put a strain on their relationship, and makes it harder for her to put in her standard 12-hour days. In this case, well-timed absences do make the heart grow fonder. How is he going to like being first husband? We may find out sooner rather than later. Let's see how the next half hour goes. Next to her, filling in for her husband as a breakfast partner, her chief of staff, Peter Evian. He holds out his phone, showing her the time. 6:56. She gives him a quick nod. Madam Vice President, he says, loud enough for the agents in front to hear. Since we have a few minutes before our reservation, would you mind if I made a personal call? Not at all, Pete. Go right ahead. I'll just step out. Take your time. And she knows, for appearance's sake, that Peter will do just that. He will call his mother and have a nice, long, documented phone call with her. Peter leaves the car and walks up 13th Street with his phone to his ear, just as a group of three joggers turns the corner from G Street Northwest and moves past him toward the vice president's limo. The joggers slow as they near the vice presidential motorcade. The man in the front of the pack, far older and less fit than his two partners, looks at the limo and seems to mention something to the others. They slow to a walk and engage with the Secret Service agent standing at their posts by her vehicle. "Madam Vice President," says her driver, tapping his ear. "The Speaker of the House is right out there. One of those joggers." "Lester Rhodes? You're kidding," she says, trying not to overdo her show of surprise. "He wants to say a quick hello." "I'd sooner set my hair on fire," she says. The agent doesn't laugh. He turns his head, waiting for more. "Shall I tell him?" "Well, I can't very well refuse him, can I? Tell him to come in." "Yes, ma'am." He speaks into his earpiece. "Give us privacy, Jay. I wouldn't want you and Eric to get burned by any fireworks." This time the agent chuckles appropriately. "Yes, ma'am." Never hurts to be careful. Secret Service agents are subject to subpoena just like anyone else. So are the Capitol Police guarding the speaker. Everyone will tell the same story under oath now, if it ever came to that. It was all a coincidence. The speaker just happened to jog by while the vice president was waiting for the cafe to open. The two agents in the front seat leave the limousine. The smell of sweat and body odor sweeps into the car as Lester Rhodes pops into the back, next to Catherine. "Madam Vice President, just wanted to say hello." The door closes behind him, just the two of them, inside the car. Lester doesn't look great in running gear. He needs to lose 3 or 4 inches in the midsection, and someone should have told him to wear longer running shorts. At least he's wearing a hat. Slate blue, with U.S. Capitol Police in red stenciling, so she doesn't have to look at that dopey, perfectly sharp part he makes in his silver hair. He lifts his hat and wipes his forehead with a sweatband. This idiot is wearing a sweatband. Correction. He's no idiot. He's a ruthless tactician who orchestrated the takeover of the House, who knows his members better than they know themselves, who plays a long political game, who never forgets anyone who crosses him, however slight the insult or disrespect, who moves the pieces of the chessboard only after careful deliberation. He turns to her, his lethal blue eyes reduced to a squint. "Kathy?" "Lester, be brief." "I have the votes in the House," he says. "The House is wrapped up like a bow. Is that brief enough?" One of the things she has learned over the years is the art of not responding too quickly. It buys you time and makes you seem more deliberative. "Don't act so uninterested, Kathy. If you weren't interested, we wouldn't be here right now." She allows his point. "What about the Senate?" she asks. His shoulders rise. "You're the president of the Senate, not me." She smirks. "But your party controls it. You get 12 on your side, I guarantee my 55 will vote to convict." The vice president adjusts in her seat to face him squarely. "And why are you telling me this, Mr. Speaker?" "Because I don't have to pull this trigger." He sits back in the seat, settles in. "I don't have to impeach him. I could just let him twist in the wind, wounded and ineffective. He's dead in the water, Kathy. He won't be reelected. I'll own him for the next 2 years. So why would I impeach him and watch the Senate remove him from office and give the voters a fresh face like you to run against?" That possibility had occurred to her, that the president was of more use to Lester Rhodes, wounded, than gone. "Because you'll be immortalized in your party for removing a president. That's why," she says. "Maybe so." He seems to relish that thought. "But there are more important things." "There's something more important to you than being speaker for life?" Lester helps himself to a bottle of water in the side compartment, screws off the top, takes a big swallow, then smacks his lips with satisfaction. "One thing is more important, yes," he says. She opens her hands. "Do tell." A wide smile crosses his face, then disappears. "It's something President Duncan would never do," he says. "But President Brandt, in her infinite wisdom, might." Chapter 55. "There's going to be a vacancy on the court," says Lester. "Oh?" She hadn't heard that. You never know with these justices, most of whom stay in their seats until they're well into their 80s. Who? He turns and looks at her, his eyes narrowing, a poker face. Deciding, she thinks. Deciding whether to tell me. Whitman got some very bad news from his doctor a week ago, he says. Justice Whitman is... It was bad news, he says. Voluntarily or otherwise, he won't make it through this presidential term. He's being urged to step down right now. I'm sorry to hear that, she says. Are you? A wry smile creeps across his face. Anyway, do you know what hasn't happened in a long time? There's been no Midwesterner on the Supreme Court since John Paul Stevens. Nobody from a federal court like the Seventh Circuit, the Heartland. The United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. If memory serves her, that court covers federal cases from Illinois, Wisconsin, and Indiana. Lester's home state. Of course. Who, Lester? The former Attorney General of Indiana, he says. Female. Moderate. Well-respected. Got nearly unanimous approval from the Senate 4 years ago for the appeals court, including your vote. Good and young, 43 years old, so that's good legacy building. She could sit on the court for 30 years. She's from my side of the aisle, but she'll vote your way on the issues your people seem to care about. The vice president's mouth drops open. She leans into him. Jesus, Lester, she says. You want me to put your daughter on the Supreme Court? She tries to remember what she knows about Lester's daughter. Married with a few kids, Harvard undergrad, Harvard law. She worked in Washington, moved back home to Indiana, and ran for attorney general as a moderate counterweight to her father's fire and brimstone politics. Everyone assumed the next step was the governorship, but then she went wonky and took an appointment to the federal appeals court. And yes, then Senator Catherine Brandt voted yes on her nomination to the appeals court. The report on her was that she was nothing like her father. If anything, she veered in the other direction, party affiliation notwithstanding. Smart and sensible. Lester frames a newspaper headline with his hands. Bipartisan, 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 he says. A new day after the gridlock of the Duncan administration. She'll be confirmed easily. I can guarantee the senators on my side, and your side will be happy. She's pro-choice, Kathy, which seems to be all your people care about. Might not be so crazy. You'll start your presidency with a big win. Hell, you play this right, Kathy? You could serve nearly 10 years in office. The vice president looks out the window. She remembers that rush when she first announced, when she was the favorite, when she could see it, feel it, taste it. Otherwise, says Lester, you won't serve one day. I'll keep Duncan in office. He'll get crushed in the re-election. And you'll be at a dead end. He's probably right about the next election. She wouldn't be at a dead end, as he's saying, but it would be an uphill battle to run 4 years later as a former vice president who lost a re-election bid. And you're okay, she says, with my serving 2.5 terms as president? The Speaker of the House slides toward the door, reaches for the handle. What the hell do I care who the president is? She shakes her head, bemused but not particularly surprised. You gotta get those 12 votes in the Senate, though, he says, wagging a finger. And I suppose you have an idea how I would do that. Speaker Rhodes moves his hand off the door handle. As a matter of fact, Madam Vice President, I do.
Chapter 56. The assembled dignitaries eat a light breakfast of bagels and fruit and coffee in the eat-in kitchen overlooking the backyard and woods as I update them on where we are so far. I've just received an update on Los Angeles where Homeland Security and FEMA, under DHS's umbrella, are working with the city and the state of California on the delivery of clean water. There have always been contingency plans for the suspension or failure of water purification plants. So in the short term, while there will be a sense of urgency to get the plant up and running again, with any luck, it will never bloom into a full-scale crisis. I won't send my imminent threat response team out there, but we're sending everyone else we have.
I may be wrong about L.A. It may not be a decoy. It might be ground zero for whatever's coming. If that's true, I've made an enormous mistake. But without more to go on, I'm not letting go of my team. They're currently in the basement with Augie and the cybersecurity experts from Israel and Germany, working in concert with the rest of our team stationed at the Pentagon. Chancellor Jürgen Richter sits with his one aide, a fair young man named Dieter Kohl, the head of Germany's BND, its International Intelligence Service. Prime Minister Noya Baram brought her chief of staff, a stout, former, older man who once served as a general in the Israeli army. We're trying to keep this meeting a secret, which means we had to keep it small. One leader and one aide each, plus their technical gurus. This is in 1942, when FDR and Churchill met secretly at a spot just off the Intracoastal Waterway in southern Florida for a series of war conferences. They ate at a great restaurant called Cap's Place and sent their owners letters of appreciation, which are now the treasures of an eatery otherwise known for its seafood, key lime pie, and 1940s atmosphere. Nowadays, with an emboldened and ravenous press, the internet and social media, all eyes on world leaders day and night, it is exceptionally difficult for any of us to move about incognito. The only thing in our favor is security. Given terrorism threats these days, we are able to keep the specifics of our travel plans under wraps. Noya Baram is attending a conference tomorrow in Manhattan and said she was using Saturday to visit family in the United States. Considering she has a daughter who lives in Boston, a brother outside Chicago, and a grandchild completing her freshman year at Columbia, her alibi is plausible. Whether it will hold up is another story. Chancellor Richter used his wife's cancer as a cover, moving up a scheduled trip to Sloan Kettering to yesterday, Friday. Their stated plan is to spend the weekend in New York City with friends. "Excuse me," I say to the group gathered in the cabin's living room as my phone buzzes. "I have to take this call. It's one of those days." I wish I had an aide with me, too, but I need Carolyn at the White House, and there isn't anybody else I can trust. I move on to the deck overlooking the woods. The Secret Service is taking the lead, but there is a small contingent of German and Israeli agents in the yard and spread out around the property. "Mr. President," says Liz Greenfield, "the girl, Nina, her fingerprints came back. Her name is Nina Shinkuba. We don't have much of a dossier on her, but we think she was born almost 26 years ago in the Abkhazia region of the Republic of Georgia." "The separatist territory," I say. "The disputed territory." The Russians backed Abkhazia's claim of autonomy from Georgia. The 2008 war between Russia and Georgia was fought over it, at least ostensibly.
"Yes, sir. Nina Shinkuba was suspected by the Georgian government of bombing a train station in the Georgian side of the disputed border in 2008. There was a series of attacks on both sides of the border before the war broke out between Abkhazia and Georgia."
"Which became the war between Russia and Georgia. She was a separatist?"
"Apparently. The Republic of Georgia calls her a terrorist."
"So that would put her in the category of anti-Western," I say. "Would it also make her pro-Russian?"
"The Russians were with them. The Russians and Abkhazians fought on the same side of that war. It's a logical inference."
"But not an automatic one."
"Should we reach out to the Georgians to see what else we can learn about her?"
"Hold that thought," I say. "I want to ask someone else first." Chapter 57. "I only knew her as Nina," says Augie, haggard from his work in the basement, rubbing his eyes as we stand together in the cabin's living room. "No last name. That didn't strike you as odd? You fell in love with a woman and you didn't know her last name." He lets out a sigh. "I knew she had a past she was escaping. I did not know the details. I did not care."
I watch him, but he doesn't say more. Doesn't seem to be struggling to explain himself any more than that. She was an Abkhazian separatist, I say. They worked with the Russians.
So you've said. If she was...